This is Parking in Bitterman Circle number 50 for July 26th, 2020. Hi, this is Aaron. Welcome to Parking in Bitterman Circle. Today, our guest is Terry Lawless. He's going to tell us a little bit about both sides of the spectrum. So who are you and where are you from?
Well, my name's Terry Lawless. I'm from the great state of Iowa. Born in Council Bluffs, educated in the great state of Iowa. And by the way, I owe everything I am to the education and the teachers that I had growing up in Iowa. When I was about 29, almost 30, I moved to California to be a little closer to the industry and for a couple of personal reasons, and just love it so much here that I never, ever, ever moved.
I had a similar route as far as seeing pretty girls and palm trees on one trip, and I was done for. I had to move.
Well, back in 71 and 72, I was a member of the McDonald's All-American Band, where they take two from every state and they make a big marching band. And I came out to the Rose Parade for that and was just hooked. It's just gorgeous here. Love it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you're I mean, it's funny because that's definitely one of those parts of the world where music is centered. I think nowadays, especially with the way transportation has been before for all these changes, you live pretty much anywhere. Mm-hmm. But for the time being, in the mid 80s, I moved to LA, and that was where everything was happening.
You know, I hit a funny spot. I was living right down in LA for quite a few years, met my wife down there, and we settled in down there. And the day that they put metal detectors on the school doors in Northridge, we took a trip up to Carmel and stopped in every little city on the way back down to LA, and picked up real estate ads, what have you, and found a big piece of dirt here in Santa Maria. And for the longest time, we lived outside of town on 160 acres out there. And it was just the perfect spot. I could get home from living 6 feet away from 10 other guys all day long to my mailbox being a half mile from the front door. So it was perfect for me.
Yeah, well, there's a while back where I ended up pretty close in Colorado. I was we were looking at some property where they had a house on a acre, but then there was 99 additional acres which were you couldn't develop on. So it kind of, you know, that looked very appealing to me for a while there until they had those floods and lions, and that wasn't the only reason we didn't go, but it was it was very appealing. I too come from the country, so it's understandable. So, I mean, what do you do now? I mean, I know from Facebook and other things that, you know, you are spending a lot of your time playing now.
Well, yeah, I'm a big believer in a couple things. When I'm on the road, I make sure I always have an exit strategy. I would guess, and I try to teach my kids, no matter what your occupation is, you should always have an exit strategy. I always keep a few irons in the fire, and two of them are always hot. But I was playing with bands around here and driving and really not making any money. And I said to myself, you know how to to make some money in this business. Why don't you just treat this like a business? And so I just took the skills that I had and made a job out of it. I spent probably 3 or 4 years on the road in hotel rooms writing multi-track karaoke for a company, and just decided, well, heck, why don't I just take this skill and take it down to the local level? So I decided to start doing a single, a one-man show. But I try to bring as much from the big stage, the world stage, down to the local thing as I can. So I always bring lights. I use in-ear monitors. The whole thing. I package it correctly so I can get in and out very quickly. And before the virus hit, I was on track for 250 local shows. But now that's doing quite a bit, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I was doing. And I play a lot of instruments. So that's what I incorporated. And I actually looked at, of all people, I looked at DJs. And I said, what makes DJs so popular? And the two things that I came up with is a huge repertoire or a wide variety of music so you can cover anybody that's in the audience, and back-to-back music. So I do 3 hours straight without any breaks, one tune right after another, and play it on a lot of instruments. I play saxophones, flutes, keyboards, even accordion, and it's worked out very well for me. You just take your skills, your strengths, and you roll with them. And it's just like we've seen in every band we've ever worked with. They don't necessarily all have the same skills, but they just take what their strengths are and they make their careers out of those strengths.
Yeah. I mean, we've come across people where the sum is greater than the parts pretty much every time.
Absolutely.
Even with solo artists, you'll find that in their bands, if they're wise and how they pick their team.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a chance to study the arts when you were a kid, when you were coming up through school?
Oh, absolutely. I was a product of the door-to-door accordion salesman when I was about 6 years old, where they would sell you an accordion, they would give you lessons. And as soon as it was paid off, you never saw them again. And then my folks took my older brother and me to an accordion school, a music school in Omaha that my brother is much better at it now than I am. But it's just a good double for me. I started playing saxophone in the schools, and I started playing double reeds and actually have my degrees in double reeds and oboe and bassoon. Went to Coke College in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and then on to the University of Iowa for my advanced degrees. But I'm a believer, and I speak with kids quite a bit, and this is one of the points that I talk about, is that you just bring a bigger skill set to every job, and you're probably going to get the job. Because there are 1,000 people that, say, for example, my current job, among the things that I do with the Irish band U2 is play keyboards. There are a million better keyboard players than me in the world. And I mean a million. And that's a conservative estimate. But no one brings the other skills, computer skills, transcription skills, which is a big thing for me with them, that none of them really read music much. The Edge studied in school, but one of the things that they have me do is, and my particular gift is, as fast as they can play something at me or sing something to me, I can write it down and preserve it. So 2 months later, when they say, now, what did we do with blah, 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 blah? Here it is. And it comes right. And they've never had anybody that with that skill before. So when I talk to kids, I say, you know, you can probably make a pretty good picture with that box of 12 Crayola crayons. But if you have that deluxe box of 144, then you don't have to work so hard at finding salmon or finding periwinkle when you need it. You just give yourself options. And that's a big thing in just about any occupation you're going to get, is giving yourself options.
Mm-hmm. So what was the first concert you attended?
Oh, way back, let's say mid-60s somewhere, my older brother that's 5 years older than me heard me singing Lightning Strikes by Lou Christie with the headphones on and my little reel-to-reel, three-inch reels that I bootlegged off the radio. And he kind of shook his head, and he took me with him to see James Brown at the Civic Auditorium in Omaha. And it was kind of like that scene in the Blues Brothers where the light comes down out of the sky. And I was hooked. I was absolutely hooked from that point.
Yeah, that's the next question. And occasionally we do get the same, the first concert and then this one, which was the I've got to do that moment. You know, when you see what's in front of you and you go, yep, sign me up. I'm ready to go.
Well, I did have other things I wanted to do. I have a degree in math. I taught school for a while. But at some point, you just say, you know, I've been trained and educated at this, and there's some money available. Why don't I go this way? And it's a misconception to me that people only do this because they love music. I always tell people I do this because this is what I have been trained and educated to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as simple as that.
Well, I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, a lot of people look at what we do and think that it's you're somebody's pal, or, you know, you could play the guitar real well and that's why they have you. And it turns into a completely different thing.
Well, those things help.
They sure do.
Without a doubt. You know, mm-hmm. They help. But this is what I've been trained and educated to do. And it's been a pretty good living.
Yeah. Did you have a mentor?
I actually had a few mentors at different stages of my life. And maybe the biggest, this is going to sound funny, but I had a job with Barry Manilow. And I started out taking care of the, being a keyboard roadie, taking care of the keyboards on that. And then they let the guitar tech go, and it wasn't very demanding. They just kind of said, you know, if you had a little extra money, can you tune guitars before the show? And they'll take care of them during the show. I don't even think they had spare guitars and basses on this show. I just mm-hmm. tuned them before the show. Yeah, sure. A little extra money. I was happy. And then a little while later, can you set up the grand piano? Sure. I help do that every day anyway. I can do that. Well, we'll give you a little extra money. And of course, they're saving flights and per diems and all that. And I wouldn't do it to lever anybody out, but if someone was leaving, yeah, I'll take that over. And then pretty soon, I was taking care of keyboards, guitars, basses, the Barry's grand piano, and we would just bring a tuner in every day. And then I was singing and dancing in the show. Mm-hmm. And I actually made as much money as most of the guys playing in the band. And I was happy. And Barry said to me one day, you know, success is preparation meets opportunity. And he kind of took me by the shoulders and he said, it's always a question of being in the right place at the right time, but you have to produce when you get that shot.
Yeah. And
that was a very mentoring moment for me.
Yeah. It's what did they give you that you still carry with you? Obviously, you've just told us one element of it. But I mean, some mentors, some people that came along for me were just gave me these sort of values that I still seem to hang on to. Like, well, I mean, the one I always say, one of the earliest people that I worked for was Lee Ritenour, and he said to me, "Know your place." And I was wondering why he was telling me that, but it made sense in the end. You know, I mean, it was one of those things where, I mean, people sometimes come into job situations for all the wrong reasons. And I think I learned from that I was learning all the good reasons to carry on with what I was doing.
Well, that's a really good one. When I worked for David Bowie, I found him to be the most inspiring man, because he was a workaholic and great at anything that he tried. And I had a moment where it was before rehearsal. I was in maybe an hour early. I had everything ready, and I was working on one of my own tunes. And there's the tap on the shoulder. "Hey, Tel, what are you doing?" You know, "Oh, well, you know, we're not really started yet." So I was working on, "Well, let's hear it." And he puts the cans on and he says, "You know, right here, why don't you take that another direction? Everyone expects you to go this direction, you know." And yeah, okay, how about, no, yeah, go that way. And he is the one that said to me, and this is the thing that has stuck with me forever, "Good enough is not good enough." And that's the biggest thing that I've ever been told.
That's a good one. Being a backline guy myself, one of the questions I always have is, what do you think about the difference between musical techs and technical techs? I mean, you know, it's really very weird, because you can come into this line of work and find out that people that are working at a very high level don't really have anything to do with music. I mean, they seem to they've taken it on as a craft, and they run with it.
You know, that's an interesting question, because there's success both ways. And I've always found that if you keep a balance of the technical side and the musical side, then when you're making technical decisions, you can do them musically. And those are the guys that are really the most valuable. Although we both know guys that are guitar techs that really didn't have a lot of musical background, but they learned exactly what they needed. And it's they bring so many other things, loyalty, friendship, because when it comes down to it, our job as a tech is just to make the performer only think about his performance and nothing else.
Yeah.
And the way we do it, we try to make every day feel like the last venue. We try to make every venue feel exactly the same. We don't want the artist thinking about whether his amp is going to have that crackle in it today. We want him only thinking about making that music. And I don't think you have to have the musical background to do this. I don't think you have to have the technical. Well, you know, maybe you need the technical. But you don't have to have the musical. But sometimes you can make a decision for the artist that saves them from making a decision. Particularly, let's take, for example, when you're making keyboard patches. There was a fellow that I worked with, a young guy, that said, "You know, I made a great clavinet. Can you, in my room rig?" He was a drum tech at the time. And he said, "Can you listen to it?" "Well, sure." And I listened to it. "Yeah, that's a great sound, but it doesn't feel like a clavinet. A clavinet's only got this much throw in it. And there's, the velocity is funny compared to other keyboard." And he kind of looked at me and said, "Well, I've never played a clavinet before." And, you know, if the sound is okay for you, that's good. But if you're talking about doing it for an artist, you have to have enough of that knowledge about that instrument to know that it's going to feel right for him when he goes to it. So it's a fine line.
Yeah, I always remember Dave Grusin was writing some stuff that was supposed to be played on classical nylon string guitar. And the difference was is that he actually used voicings that were used by guitar players and not by keyboard players. So that when the guitarist came in, he could just walk away with it. You know, it was a very interesting use of the technology. But I mean, it took someone who understood arranging and and instruments to make that happen. What do you bring your clients? Do you bring them transparency or influence? I think about techs being like Sherpas or caddies as opposed to just pack mules. You know, guys who guys that bring something. I mean, it may be just a matter of giving them. You put it very, very well, and so I agree, which is what we're responsible for is the environment. We try to make their environment consistent from day to day so that they've got exactly what they need to do in order to perform.
Well, actually, I mean,
you are in a very unique situation because you are clearly in a musical area and a technical area with the people you work with.
You know, the guys, particularly one of the guys that I work with, always call me their music director. And to not really even, you know, I'm not out on stage with them, but it's kind of they're the Broadway cast and I'm the pit orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
So I consider myself the conductor of that pit orchestra. And they'll ask me questions like, you know, we're going from this chord and we want to end up on this chord. What do you think we should do? What would be a smooth transition? And in the recording studio, when they would sing me a line that they wanted me to play, or they would bring in a part they played on strings, I would say, well, you know, that's not really how string players would play this or voice this.
Yeah.
And so they respect that from me, and I think they rely on me to give them that information. And I do it in such a way that I just drop the information out there, and what they do with it is their choice. And that works well for us.
Yeah, expanding on that, there is a very delicate line between collaboration and support. And sometimes there's a danger in influencing the musician you're talking to, almost like putting so much into their minds that they're not paying attention to what their goal is anymore. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, we do that. I mean, at least I've done it. And I know that eventually looking back on it, that maybe it wasn't the most appropriate thing to do. Sometimes I'm also talking about gigs where, your creativity is not a consideration by the artist. They don't want to know about it. They want you to be invisible.
Exactly. Invisibility is a big thing in our business. And, mm-hmm. you know, this is kind of goes along with this. I tell people that when I'm on the road, I can't wait to be home doing local venues. And they can't believe it. Mm-hmm. And I tell them that two schools of thought. When I'm out with a world-class band, they find the best way to present every single song. And by God, that's the way it's going to be presented every night. And we have to do it that way because we have to be synchronous with lights, with video, with sound. Everybody has to know what's going on in this stage drama, which is what we do. Mm-hmm. When I'm home, I am from the Miles Davis school that I don't know what I'm going to play until the horn hits my mouth. And to me, music is about creativity, but you just can't do it when you're on the scale that we work with.
Right.
So this is the way I say when I'm on the road, it's about, well, when I'm home, it's about creation. When I'm on the road, it's about recreation. And that's the way you have to look at it. And both are valid, and both are exactly correct for the situation that you're in. But it keeps me in a kind of a schizophrenia about music all the time.
Yeah, one of the jobs that I did in the past 10 years, I was responsible for a separate system that was taken into every venue so that the band could warm up or work on ideas or test new equipment. It was just having like a they called it a tuning room, but they ended up, I mean, basically what it was a little laboratory to make sure that everybody get their attitude in the right place before they get on stage. And more than anything, get on stage with a head of steam rather than being so cold when you start.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a rehearsal room as well.
Yeah. And it was one of those things where, when I got called in, it was getting out of control. They had a small SSL console and a bunch of powered wedges and a lot of work boxes. And, you know, I eventually downsized myself out of a job, but, that was kind of the goal, was to get it down, get it stripped down and get it to a point where they get everything that they possibly need. And to accomplish what they were looking to do, which was, you know, could be one of a handful of things.
Well, now see, with the current band that I'm with, they think that it isn't really working unless it's an exact duplication of what they have on stage.
Correct, which is where we ended up, especially since that particular band, we switched from regular tube amps to like fractals. So we could actually, if there was any change made on stage, the techs would come down from the stage and put the new patches in and away we go.
Yeah.
A few years back, David Byrne wrote a book called How Music Works. And one of the concepts he was talking about was how the music style ends up being influenced and influencing the room, you know. He talked about how architecture helped music evolve. There's a great TED talk that he does as well, talking obviously about places like CBGB's where they started out and then taking it all the way to the arenas and stadiums that we do. And then how even during the 1600s, 1700s, there was a difference in how people wrote depending on the size of the room you were in. You couldn't play really intricate stuff in a large Gothic cathedral because there's just too much reverb, but you could do sort of elaborate and long, you know, long notes and all of that kind of stuff in a place like that. But he was saying how the venue would actually end up influencing the music, which I found a very fascinating concept.
Well, you know, not only just the venue, but the instruments in those venues. Up until, 1750 with Bach and the tuning that we use nowadays, pipe organs couldn't play in A flat. Mm-hmm. They were horribly out of tune, and they called it the wolf, I think. When Bach was introducing the well-tempered clavier, yeah, he intentionally wrote pieces that exposed that. Pipe organs had to be refitted for this temperament. But I think that things are changing quite a bit because of technology, because of so much of the music written in hotel rooms on laptops with a keyboard. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've noticed this, Aaron, but to me, I can hear in 90% of pop music that keyboard parts have been written on a 2-octave keyboard. And it completely goes by most people because it's just a fluff to the tune or a motif that doesn't have any kind of distance at all. Two-handed keyboard playing is gone nowadays, for the most part. Like I say, 90%, because, of course, there are exceptions. Alicia Keys comes to mind right away. things like that that you don't realize are happening in music. Suddenly the 88 keys have shrunk down to 25. That is the same concept. And that's an interesting concept. I'd love to read that book. I like reading about the temporal part of music. Mm-hmm. If you listen to, music has evolved, look at the difference between the instrumentation, the arrangement, everything of, say, the Miles Davis Sextet, everybody being in a room about the size of this studio, and a hair band playing to 25,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that's what David Byrne was talking about. It's a definite influence. I can see that for sure. Yeah. The guys I work with, and I keep referencing them, are great writers, and they'll start with a small idea that they do in hotels, but then it doesn't develop until they actually get into a 40 by 60 room. And then the mixer has the 20,000 plus audience in mind when he mixes, and every one of them do great at that level. So I think it's true, and I think I don't think there's any way around saying that it's not true.
No, I mean, I think anthems in small places can be problematic.
Yeah,
but
isn't that the truth?
Yeah. Technology versus the ear. You know, they've made advances so fast with computers and hardware. Dependence on new gear is it making things better, or is it making another generation not willing to listen or feel the room? And I mean, I think I'm actually picking on people with digital consoles in that particular question, because now we're seeing people that don't have that same sort of organic approach when it comes to giving people what they need to hear.
Well, there are two questions here, because people always resist the new technology and poo-poo it as non-musical. Mm-hmm. Case in point would be auto-tune, which gets used everywhere. And to me, it's no different than when I was growing up with the big bands, and they would laugh at guys multi-tracking and punching in. They would say, well, why can't they just play it in one take and record that, you know? And in a way, they're right, but we use the technology of the day. As technology makes things easier, I think it allows people into the business that really don't have any business there, because we've got a lot of people that can't even play their instruments. One band that I toured with and shall remain, they were a support act, but the bass player really only played on one string of the bass. And sometimes that was the only string that was tuned, and it would be da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And it makes me sad that we just don't have the virtuosos that we did in our days, because to us, that was the big part of the music, was the guys that knew their instruments and came up with all these things. The great thing is that technology kind of weeds itself out. I mean, how many tunes are written on a drum machine anymore? I mean,
right.
We have samples and we have 4 and 8 bar loops of real drummers, but there just isn't much of that anymore. It weeded itself out because people just, well, that was easy, but it doesn't sound anywhere near like what we want to hear. The other thing would be like GarageBand. Well, yes, you may have a string part in there, but it isn't necessarily the string part that you hear in your head. So as people get more demanding for making their music better, they push those aside and they go to a more musical approach. And I think that happens all the time and it weeds itself out.
Yeah, I mean, the same thing. Now I'm going to pick on the audience just a little bit, being that they deserve it. Digital versus analog. Are there, you know, we've raised a couple of generations worth of MP3 listeners who have never really heard a full range show until they get to a concert or maybe a nice piece of vinyl on a great system or something. But I mean, people are literally listening to stuff which is distorted. You know, it's distorted on either end. You know, the high end, the low end is all distorted, and it's not, they're not getting a realistic experience with the sound given to them, because, and for economic reasons more than anything, or in the old days, hard drive space, which we now is as cheap as cell phones, I think. So,
well, you know, David Bowie hit me to this long before it actually happened. He said, the way that music has become the background while we walk to work, the background while we're on the stair stepper, and the way it's so easily stolen, recorded music doesn't have any value anymore. The value is in the live show. Mm-hmm. And I think the value less music become as adaptable as listening to music over the speakers at the supermarket. Great recordings are not listened to anymore.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. And the only place that there's any value in music anymore is in the live show. So it may be moot. Because,
yeah,
why polish that valueless entity? To me, there's a convenience to having your whole library in your hand. I'd never put it on my phone, and I don't think there are any tunes on my phone right now, because when I listen to music, I listen until the battery is dead, and that's the last thing I want to happen on my phone.
Right, exactly.
I carry a lossless handheld with me now, and I can listen in highest fidelity that I can get out of earbuds. And I usually use my stage earbuds for that, mm-hmm. but they're not really designed for that. But that's the closest thing that that I can do to do it. But there's nothing, absolutely nothing. And I'm fortunate enough to sit in front of studio monitors most of the day if I want to, mm-hmm. because I still write production music and I listen to music on studio monitors almost all day. Mm-hmm. So fidelity for you, for me and you, is a different thing than the average consumer nowadays. And there's no value in paying a monthly fee and then just pulling out like a jukebox. I own all my own music, and I have never listened to Spotify or any of those services. I'm still a little old school about that. I'm old school about buying used CDs because no money goes to the artists. I'm a big proponent of old school, and I'd like to see those values come back.
Yeah. It was funny that during a time when after Napster and before Spotify, there was a number of peer-to-peer programs out there, which I did find myself using because at that point, and probably still at this point, 80% of recorded music is not for sale. You know, the only thing that the big companies would put out is stuff that they could get a guaranteed revenue from. So I was looking for old ECM records and, you know, all kinds of obscure stuff. And I was having a conversation with Alan Fitzgerald, and he was telling me that for him, it was a big deal because, you know, depending on how much money was still coming in from the old Night Ranger stuff would make a difference to where his daughter would end up going to college. Mm. And I was just like, it put a human face on the situation that I've never I've never gotten over. I mean, it was, he shared that with me, and I was just like, I guess it really does come down the line to everybody, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Fitz is a great example of the music business. Here's a guy that was playing stadiums, mm-hmm. and then things, you know, they everyone has their up and then their ebb. And he changed gears, and instead of trying to being a musician to death, he got in on the technical end and did extremely well there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good guy. Like him.
Yeah. 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 Tell me what your proudest moment is, professional or personal.
Oh, that's a good question. I guess professionally, being on stage with U2 and Paul McCartney in front of 180,000 people and millions worldwide for the beginning of Live 8 in Hyde Park. Mm-hmm. And professionally, that was probably the highlight. Maybe second to that was getting the call on my answering machine, back when I had an answering machine. And I've saved the recording of The Edge saying, we'd like to have you come over and play on the next album. And that was a highlight. And actually, the two corresponded, because there I was, and granted, I was behind a wall of amps doing some playing there. And here, U2, Paul McCartney on the same stage that Pink Floyd is going to be on in 30 minutes. Or 40 minutes or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I kind of got a little depression there, because what do I do from here? I always try to move forward and upward. What can I possibly do that will? And just as I'm about ready to open a vein with a razor blade, I get the call from The Edge, and he said, can you come over and play on the record? And to me, it's a proud point, because that's as close to immortality as any of us will ever see. 200 years from now, when someone says, hey, who played that opening organ thing on Moment of Surrender? And they go into the Library of Congress and there's my name. You know, mm-hmm. that's as close to immortality as I'll ever get. Personally, I would have to say that, watching the birth of my kids, those are my proudest moments.
This is something that probably some of the people that don't do what we do but wish they did, if they're listening. What are your thoughts about road life and travel, and what does it take to be a person in constant movement like that?
Well, the only way that, and everybody does differently, the only way that I can do it is I gave up, I went completely sober. That was a big part of it, because I couldn't do that day after day and function my job. I'm an absolute loner on the road. The only way I can stand to be around that many people all the time is to be completely anonymous on days off. I hardly ever, unless it's a baseball game, I hardly ever do anything with anybody on the road. And it's because it's the only way I can survive. We're around 100 people all day long. We sleep, like I said before, 6 feet from 10 other guys at night on a bus. We eat in catering all day, where you can't even just ask for what you really feel like you want to eat. But it's the only way that this business can work. And I think being alone is the only way that I can do it, and not just being a vegetable when I'm alone. I'm always have something in my room that I'm practicing, that I'm formulating tracks for tunes. And it was a big thing for me when I started multi-tracking classic tunes. It gave me a little purpose to get back to my hotel room. I look forward to that. Keeping healthy, eating healthy, getting enough sleep, and just coming in with the idea that you're there for a job. And because a lot of guys get depressed, and you and I have worked together with some guys that you knew really wanted to be a player. And it was very depressing and very demeaning for them to not be the player there. And in their mind, you could just see, I know I could play that better than them. I know I could. Mm-hmm. But it just doesn't work that way. You get hired for a job, that's the job you do. And it's a very simple method for me. Stay alone, stay busy, stay healthy.
I tell you, I ended up getting sober decades ago now. And
how long ago?
30 years.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
I'm in the same boat.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Wouldn't be here otherwise.
I would be. And, you know, I mentioned before, I talk to kids a lot at schools, and eventually the question always comes up, what about sex, drugs, rock and roll? And I put up 8 names on a board and say, you know, this was the first road crew I ever worked with. Draw a line through this one. He's in jail. These two died of AIDS. These two were alcoholics and died of cirrhosis. And pretty soon I'm the only one left there. And I say, I'm the only one left. You do the math. And then I just move on to another question and I don't dwell on it. And you can just see the look on the faces of the, you know, here's something going on here. And that seems to be the best way for me to get that point across.
That's a good thing. I mean, I think that the humility that people have when they get out of that self-centered kind of lifestyle. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's like they say in one of the programs, which is it's attraction rather than promotion. And you know, I mean, that's all any of us can do, you know. And I've actually been fortunate where you know, I've had people come up to me while we work. You know, it's hard for me to have sort of a home life here with that, but all of a sudden now on the road, I've been able to be of service to people other than the guys I'm already working for. And that's been one of the greatest blessings I've ever had.
And I have worked with bands that have guys that are going through the program or want to stop. And they actually have come to me and said, how did you do it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very rewarding. And teaching too. I'm surprised how much I learn when I teach. And those two go hand in hand.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you on that one. Well, we were just talking about this before. The element of crew, is the crew a team or is it a collection of coordinated loners? You know, and which of that, I mean, you've already said that, I mean, you find your own time in order to keep your sanity. But it's especially on a large tour, which we've both been fortunate enough to do. There's a lot of people, a lot of moving parts. Sometimes it really does get so that you're very tunnel visioned on your job because you're like the only advocate for the person that's not there. You know, you're setting up. They're like, okay, can you move over there today? And it's like, no, I can't. You know, this is the way it is.
Well, again, it's a balance because, you know, some people wouldn't survive as a loner. Look at the problems some people have quarantining right now.
Right.
They have their own method of surviving on the road, whether it's a road romance that 99% of the time doesn't work out, but there's that 1% that does. Whether it's someone that as soon as they get off work, the only way they can come down from the intensity of it is drugs and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And they're up first thing in the morning and somehow make it work. but it just didn't work for me.
Yeah, same here.
It's a loner thing. It's a take care of your own job, but the only way the system works on the road, particularly as you get larger, is you hire people to do their particular job. You have one person to oversee it and pull it together. And then those overseers are overseen and pull it together. Mm-hmm. And you focus on the big picture all the time, but with relation to your own job.
Right.
That's the only way to do it.
I think that it comes with age, though. I mean, because I know a lot of people who think that they can still do the myopic version of things. And eventually, I mean, if you've got a team approach, it's like I went from doing like, you know, dozens of semis kind of tour down to now doing like a bus with a 16-foot trailer. And I've had some more of an appreciation of the fact I sat there and I said, well, I'm glad that we don't have 16 more trucks to pack at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, this is enough. This is mm-hmm. more than enough. And, but what did I bring from the large show down to this show was that attention to detail and the fact that the big picture is the only picture.
It is the only picture. Yeah. The big picture is the only picture. And if you keep that in mind while you're doing your job, then it all comes into focus without a doubt. Here I am, not in my current situation, but I'm usually the oldest guy. I'm the guy that if I'm playing parts off stage, I have to watch my fingers, whatever. But who do you think loads a truck every night? Mm-hmm. And it's because I look at the big picture and because I would rather load it correctly than fix it at the next gig. So there's a bit of laziness involved there at the same time. But that's big picture, little picture, and the blend of the two. You throw the different hat on when the show's over. You throw another hat on when you're on the bus. You throw another hat on when you get up in the morning. Mm-hmm. And it's a very schizophrenic life for you and I. I've used that word a couple times now, but mm-hmm. I've got my circle of world touring. I've got my family life. I've got my local playing. Mm-hmm. And there's that little spot right in the middle that you have to be. And when you meet somebody on the street, it's just such an odd thing. And I'm sure this happens to you. Mm-hmm. First thing you do is figure out which circle they're from, and then you recognize their name from there.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. Sometimes it's like you came from a different universe. That if one of them pops into your real life, whatever your real life really is.
That's right.
You know, actually, the best line Chainsaw said a couple weeks ago when I interviewed him, that guitar roadie fixes things when they're broken. A guitar tech fixes it before it's broken.
Oh.
You know, that kind of you know, proactive kind of
thing. Yeah, absolutely.
This is going to be fun. I know this because of when we met. The question is about whinging and windups. You know, complaining is an art form. And is the hazing that we do or did in the old days, is that just a way to thin the herd a little bit?
Oh, no. It's actually, I think hazing, because it's done in such good spirit, is just a method of showing the person that you're accepting them. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's not anything malicious at all that goes on. I didn't do it as much as I got older.
Yeah,
it's funny, but it's still in your mind when you got hazed yourself. Mm-hmm. And so you want to get in on the fun, I guess, a little bit. But it is a very different world these days. Hazing kind of is a no-no in the corporate world that we now live in. I guess because there are ramifications from it now. I don't know why else, but I think that we think in terms of we have to be maybe even legally don't do this to people anymore.
Well, it's not like we tour with an HR person. But
yeah, but we have to.
It's getting there.
It's in our mind all the time. And our production manager and our tour manager are our HR people. And they will come in and say, okay, enough's enough. And the worst ones are when we have nepotism from the artist and they want their nephew to do this or they, you know, and it's really hard to hold back. And you kind of do it because you know it might come back to you. That it's a different world. And I just don't know how to even answer that anymore because it's just a different world.
That's true. I mean, maybe glow tape and lettuce is not the way to go, you know, anymore.
No, but probably not. We probably just, instead of... you know, poking fun at what people do, we probably just let them attempt it and then give the old fatherly arm around the shoulder and say, you know, this is why we really don't run a guitar cable underneath the guitar stand, because mm-hmm. when someone trips on it, then you lose the guitar as well. Mm-hmm. And you let them make the mistake and then you just say, this is why we don't. And it's we turn it more into a learning experience now, I think.
Yeah. Well, I had a very wise person once tell me, he says, if you see a toothpick on the floor, pick it up. And it was like, why? And his answer was very simple. Then somebody else will have to. You know?
Yeah. There you go.
So, well, here's the big question. This is the one that we're all kind of interested in right now is... what the hell happened to our industry? This virus is, you know, we never saw this coming. I mean, we talk about having a plan B or an exit strategy, but holy moly. I mean, we used to do good when the economy was good. The economy was bad. If there was a real estate bubble, you know, everybody wanted to be entertained. But now we're kind of totally in flux.
Yeah, and... you can kind of look at it the other way too, that we cut a fat hog all the time. And like you said, it didn't matter what went on. We still had a nice, good paying job. And most of the guys didn't appreciate that. And it's coming back to bite them in the ass now. It's always a question of adapting. You see bands adapting and doing virtual broadcasts now, which we can make ourselves available as the technical person there, and there's probably money to be made. But again, once they try this, they just decide it's not the same trying to play with none of that energy feedback loop, throwing it out, bringing it back from the audience, throwing it out again. And that's what's beautiful about music is that energy loop that happens there. And I've done a couple virtual broadcasts for venues just out of respect that they gave me work. I'm going to help them out as much as I can. And it is such a hollow feeling when you finish a song and I'm the only one in the room. It's kind of like playing those gigs when you finish a song and there's no applause, there's no nothing. And you look out and they're just talking to each other and having a drink. And it's the same kind of hollow feeling. So I've kind of stopped doing that, but touring, they're trying to find ways to put bands up and in parking lots and let people stay in their cars, which might be a great idea. I've always wanted to buy a drive-in and put bands on before the movie starts.
Mm-hmm.
Same kind of deal, but I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. So it's a good idea just to hunker in and do the safety thing and try to get this over with as quickly as we can. You can sharpen your skills as a player. You can, in our business, you can try to find work helping artists put their home studios together so they can sharpen their skills and move on. I mean, you have to make your own work all the time, it comes down to.
That's true.
And you have to have a way to get out of it and something else that you can do. You're going to suffer. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, absolutely. Terry, thank you so much for your time. And it's been great talking to you, pal. I can't believe it's been almost 20 years since
we were together. Yeah, it's great to see you, Aaron. Wish you well. And I hope we save the world here.
Well, you know, maybe not the we haven't solved the cancer or put a rocket in the sky, but I think we've done well. Good work.
Well, and that's you bring that up. One of the things that has always kept me going, and about especially doing a job that I do, like doing things off stage that no one ever sees, and people talk about getting nervous. I say, I've had cancer twice. What's going to happen at a rock show that's going to make me nervous? You know, and just put it in perspective. It's a great life if you can find it. It's a fulfilling life if you don't make it your only life and stay away from your family 360 days a year.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful life for meeting and getting friendships and relationships that last forever. And I'm happy I did it. And tell you the truth, I'm kind of ready to walk away from it. So,
well, yeah, timing is everything.
Well, you keep saying that you can walk away from it, and then they keep dragging you back in. And when you think you don't have a number, somebody always finds one.
Yeah. Yeah, those phone calls still happen. But
and that's a good thing.
That's a great thing, yeah.
You know your bait's still good.
Well, take care, my friend. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. See you, Aaron.